This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 7th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 309 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show today, we'll be looking at war on its many fronts, starting with the fascinating history of the Gurkhas with Major General J.C. Lawrence. We'll be here a little bit later on.
We'll be taking a look at inequality in the cities in which we live through a filmmaker's eye. Documentary maker Catherine Round will be here to explain her vision and how it became part of the Open City Documentary Festival taking place in London later this month.
And we'll be speaking with Charles Glass, the veteran reporter and Middle East expert, about his new book on Syria.
That's all coming up, plus Tom Edwards will be looking across the major news that hasn't happened yet with a news look ahead, and we'll have some good music. Right here too, all on Monocle Weekly, here on Monocle 24. Hi Andrew, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Welcome to you
welcome
too.
Welcome one and all. The way I said good music there in the menu, it was a bit sarcastic. I'd like to point out that the music is always of a high standard.
It's an amazingly high standard.
And also, on this show at least.
On this show, no. Well, we should also give a little plug to our sister show, which is the Live Sessions. You've had amazing people in lately.
We've had some good people. I'm trying to figure out who's been on today, actually. I'm trying to figure out what we've had in the store.
Sister-in-law, I think, of the one of our new subs.
Amalka.
Well, that was a strange thing. There was a nice weird family connection with a new person who came in, and we had a new band in who, I don't know, it was all very complicated.
A nice sort of straight down the line electro pop princess, we could call her.
Can I say, that's the pinkest t-shirt I've ever seen in my life. That is your t-shirt.
No, I just got a bit of sunburn.
Okay.
You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised what you can do in a lunchtime here at Midori House.
It's been nice weather in London.
It's been all right. We've had the time to enjoy it. We kicked July, August out the bed.
Yeah, we even had an Aperol spritz moment.
Exactly.
I was spitting after my spritz, but not before.
Exactly. It's been decent. It's good. The sun has had his hat on. The weather has behaved itself, and we've had the calm after the storm after getting rid of all those things. And before we go off on all our travels for our forthcoming new issue, the sort of summer issue, the Escapers, you've already done yours. You could have done with that now probably, and that you've already had your week in Japan.
I went to the far north of Japan, and you're heading off to Thailand. But we won't tell
the north of Thailand.
Much.
I don't tell people too much, but it hasn't happened yet.
No.
There's nothing to tell. it's all just lurking.
That's
on the
all coming up. That's
so
The
far.
Escapist, which is our new summer publication, sister to the forecast. And I'm very kind of like a bikinied sister, I think, as well. It's kind of like, it's all about holiday making and travels.
The bikini sister is welcome around my house any time. It's time for the news look ahead now with the one and only Tom Edwards.
Who's got a waggy tail?
Who's got a winning grin?
Who can sniff out the spookiest news?
Who knows when to bark and bite?
Who's got the nicest coat?
Who can round up some global tales?
Who can scent a breaking story?
And who likes his tummy tickled?
Oh yes, it's that lovable news hound.
It's Tom Edwards.
Come home, Daddy.
I want to see that movie.
I can't wait for that to be turned into a major motion picture.
Give the public what they want.
Yeah.
Got to serve that up.
When you listen to that, Tom, when you listen to your theme tune, what's the breed of dogs are you imagining?
It's a range from a Parsons Jack Russell at the lower
Parsons
end.
Parsons Jack Russell.
That's the one with the longer legs.
They're the longer leg ones.
Right.
Because a dog, as you know, from a side profile should fit in a square from shoulder to withers. Separate issue.
Okay.
Up to a large, you know, one of those, like a St. Bernard or something. You know, the one that would have the little barrel of brandy around
his neck to revive you after a hard day's slog.
Yeah. And then I don't know, the dog that's saying, come home, Daddy, I don't even know what kind of animal that
it's
is.
It's a borzoi.
Something.
It's a famous borzoi. It's Tom Reynolds.
It feels like it might be one of the minor characters from Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah, or
the
something.
The depressed bloodhound.
The sequel where...
Come home, Daddy!
The sequel where it gets euthanized.
Oh, dear. Okay. Is that the style in which you want to kick off the news look ahead?
A euthanasia gag? Why not? Sunday lunchtime?
Yeah.
Get people choking on their potatoes?
Okay, let's get this news started.
What have I got? A few serious issues around the world today. 2015 African Union Summit starts in South Africa. Do you want to know this year's theme?
Yeah.
Obviously not. Let's move on. General elections taking place in Turkey.
This is a big one.
This is genuinely interesting. Yeah. So 550 members. It's the Grand National Assembly, and
the Grand National of elections.
The Grand National, Beaches Brook. The AKP party obviously has 312 seats. The Republican People's Party is the main opposition with just 125 last time. Now, it seemed that the parties, obviously, which is sort of, works with President Erdogan, who's the real power broker, will still probably return with the majority. But it's how workable that is and whether the margins are significantly decreased. And that could obviously presage some quite interesting political happenings within Turkey.
And especially because the Kurdish vote might actually go up this time, and the Kurdish parties could do well because they're pulling in some kind of opposition from, Turkish people who are not keen on what Erdogan's up to. They're backing the Kurds, are seeing them as a kind of a rebel vote.
Well, and what's interesting, I think, is we tend to talk about an intolerance of dissent when it comes to journalistic voices, for example, which is certainly the case in Turkey. But, there are dissenting political voices, and there is an opposition. How effective they can be and how effective they'll be allowed to be if they start to, get closer numbers-wise. An assembly, for example, is perhaps a different question.
Good. Next.
Also happening today, the annual baby
We're
jumping...
We're keeping it at pace today.
Listen to this. The baby jumping calacho is happening at Castrillo de Murcia in Spain. It's all to do with Corpus Christi.
Okay.
You jump over the baby or the baby does the jumping?
Yeah. Grown men, dressed as the devil...
I remember this.
They leap over babies, which is known as el colacho. But the belief is that as the devils leap, they draw in all the evil, leaving the little babies cleansed.
What's it called?
Filly boots. It's El Colacho.
Reminds me of one of my favourite Richie Beno moments when it was like, and the West Indies are 67 for 8 now. It's El Colapso. Reminds me of that.
Oh, that's pretty good.
It's all right,
El Colapso. But maybe you could, people at home perhaps could try their own versions.
No, don't.
No, put your infants down on the kids, jump over them.
It's perfectly fine, isn't it?
Dress as a devil. I mean, it's frankly terrifying, isn't it?
It's frankly terrifying.
There you go.
It sorts them out, doesn't it?
Those men from the boys.
Exactly.
Lots of flat-headed children in that village. Next.
So midweek. Let's talk about auction activity every now and again, Rob.
Yeah.
And this was one that struck me because it's actually one of an artist that I admire a great deal. CRW Nevinson, the First World War artist, famous modernist, almost like a vorticist style, fell out with Wyndham Lewis, wasn't allowed to be part of the vorticist gang. And there's a rarely available work up for sale at Bonhams. Everyone's getting very excited about this.
Oh, cool.
It's, I don't know if I've got the name of it, it's Mule Team, Mules feature. And one of the great documenters of World War One. But these are extraordinary, fractured images.
Yeah.
Real powerful artistic.
And how much do you know how much do you think it's going to be going for?
Well, it's
£75.
North of a quarter of a million, but it could be a record for Nevinson.
Yeah,
work.
Probably an artist record, right? Where all the other ones are? They're all probably in private collections.
Apparently, it's very rare that they come up, that they go under the hammer. So I don't know. Maybe he wasn't that prolific. I'm not that much of an expert, sadly.
I think you are.
I do my best.
I like that someone wasn't allowed to be in the Vorticists.
I know. That was apparently Wyndham Lewis was very, very aggressive like that.
Who's the drummer in the Vorticists again? do we have any more? Are you going to tell us what the theme of the African Nations?
We're washing over that.
Because everyone will be really disappointed that we didn't ask.
I want to talk a little bit about the World Cup before we go.
Mm-hmm.
See people's faces falling. Not the Football World Cup. It's the Tea and Coffee World Cup. Oh, yeah. This is taking place in Ho Chi Minh City.
Okay.
It's basically the trade show for tea and coffee internationally.
But it's called the Tea and Coffee World Cup.
It's called the Tea and Coffee World Cup, and I think they want to get cup in there.
Cup of tea, obviously.
More than 2,500 key decision makers in the tea industry.
Wow. Okay, so these are what are these sort of...
What are the decisions? Yeah.
Milk, sugar.
Milk and one lump. I don't know. But they're all there. They're all in Ho Chi Minh.
I'm sure that's exactly how the rest of the world drinks its tea, Tom. If they don't, then they're wrong.
It should be, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, it's all kicking off in Ho Chi Minh City.
When's that? That sounds,
get amongst it. That's from Wednesday, over a few days.
Okay, right, good.
See, Rob might be on the tea team.
Yeah.
I'd go coffee.
I'd probably go...
You'd be in that dithery, decaffeinated moment in the middle.
I need help from some of these 2,500 key decision makers.
Yeah, yeah. You do. Can you canvass all of them in one weekend?
I bet if you mentioned the D word, decaf there, you'd probably be run out of town.
You probably would, yeah.
Have to leave on a helicopter.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. That was rather glorious. You can go in the corner now. We'll tickle your tummy. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we're going to be hearing the story of the Gurkhas. Don't go away. The Gurkhas are a much storied Nepalese fighting force that have been in the service of the British Army for 200 years, where their ferociousness and adaptability is as famous as their loyalty.
But just who are the Gurkhas? How did they end up fighting with rather than against the British, and what makes them tick? Major General J.C. Lawrence has written the book on it, literally, The Gurkhas, 200 Years of Service to the Crown, proceeds of which will assist the Our Duty of Care appeal, spearheaded by the Gurkha Welfare Trust. And Major Lawrence, or Craig to his pals, joins us now. And first of all, this is a great story, isn't it? Because, as we said in the introduction there, the Gurkhas were not always on the side of the British. It was not always is going to be thus. So tell us how the relationship started.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's a fascinating story. And as you say, it's 200 years this year. In 1814, the East India Company was expanding north, and it ran across the Nepalese, who were expanding east and west, and conflict was inevitable. So that started what was called the First Afghan War. On the 31st of October 1814, a gentleman called Major General Rollo Gillespie, who was leading one of the four columns that had been dispatched to try and bring this aggressive little state to heel, was killed doing an attack, leading an attack in his frustration at a place called Kalunga against a defending force of 650 Gurkhas. And it shook British India. India, as you know, was maintained in a state of domination by the East India Company, and it was important for the East India Company that any state who, or any prince that decided he wasn't going to do what he was told, was suppressed immediately in case it spread. And that started 2 years of war, during which in April 1815, Gurkhas were first recruited.
So there's a kind of air of pragmatism about the British attitude right back then in terms of their relationship with the Gurkhas.
And you've hit it on the head. It was absolute pragmatism. They found these guys they were fighting, and they were extremely competent. And rather than oppose them, they thought, well, we'll have some of those. And so even before the war had finished, four battalions were raised in April 1815. The war against the Nepalese didn't finish until March the 3rd, 1816. And so it was, as you say, absolutely pragmatic. We'll get some of them on our side and then exploit them rather than fight them all the time.
And Craig, how quickly was the decision taken to use the Gurkhas beyond India and to kind of really integrate them into the army?
Well, up until the partition of India in 1947, the majority of native troops, Gurkhas included, were used to police the colonial empire. After 1947, after partition, there was recognition that they needed to be brought into the wider British Army. And of the 10 battalions that then existed, four came to the British Army and six remained in the Indian Army. But that isn't to say that during both the First World War and the Second World War, there were huge contributions made by Gurkhas to the conflict.
But why in 47, when the British Empire was shrinking, there was already a kind of the war was over, the army was shrinking as well. Why was the decision taken that the Gurkhas were still essential to who the British Army were, and why did we still need them?
I think it's a really good question, because there were many native regiments that were employed and formed in the British, or that fought for the British up until partition, that didn't transfer across to the British Army. You're absolutely right. I think it was recognition that they are just first-class infantry soldiers. And of course, maintaining that link with Nepal means that in times of need, like in the Second World War, like in the First World War, Britain was able to recruit huge numbers from Nepal itself. And if you think that during the First World War, for example, there were just over 90,000 Gurkhas serving in the British Expeditionary Force, and in the Second World War, the figure increases to 138,000 troops. So by maintaining that recruiting, you have access to an almost unlimited stream of young people who can fight when you need them to.
And talk us through, that your book goes into this in quite amusing detail as well, about the recruitment that the Gurkhas go through, Craig. Talk us through that, because it's not tougher for them than for anybody else, but they're certainly pretty good at jumping through the hoops and passing the tests.
Well, right? I mean, it's interesting you say that. It's one of the special interest sections, because the recruiting in Nepal is just a remarkable experience. And if you get the chance to go and see it, you should do. So in 2014, for example, there were 7,865 applicants for 230 places. So the standard, or the number of people coming forward, is just phenomenal compared to...
You get a lorry to bring the CVs in.
Well, it's that kind of thing. And so in order to try and select the very best, the standards that have been laid down, and I've gone into this in detail in the book, as you say, they are actually harder than those of the British Army. So, for example, each Gurkha soldier has to be able to do 12 pull-ups or heaves. I've never been able to do 12 pull-ups or heaves. You know, I see myself as a fit kind of guy, but that really is quite a remarkably high standard. And the thing that they do called the Doka Challenge, which is running about 2.5 miles with a pack on your back weighing 25 kilograms with a strap over your head, is to separate out, try and get these hill soldiers, which is where Gurkhas originally came from, the hills of Nepal. So the standard really is very high, but because there are so many people who want to join, I mean, Nepal is still, especially now after the earthquake, is absolutely a developing country. It's not remotely westernized in many ways. And the chance to get into the Brigade of Gurkhas and to serve overseas and to start a new life, really, is something that many Nepalese continue to want to aspire to.
And Craig, tell us about your personal experience. You've commanded many of these men. You've served alongside them. How did that come about, and what's your relationship?
It's interesting. I was sat as a youngster, I suppose I was 18 years old, watching the television at school as the British task force deployed itself to the Falkland Islands to go and retake them from the Argentinians. And I was watching this, captivated, as I suspect most of the nation was, as hill by hill, the British force slowly managed to gain control of the island. And although I admired all the courage that all the soldiers were displaying, the smiling face of the 7th Gurkhas, who'd deployed down there as well as part of the task force, was just something that absolutely intrigued me. I didn't realise we still had these characters in the British Army. And so that really started me off on this aspiration to join in 1984, which sounds an awfully long time ago now. I was commissioned into the 2nd Gurkhas. And I've served with them ever since, as you say. I commanded a company on operations. I've commanded the battalion operations. I had them in my brigade when I was a brigade commander. And I'm now privileged enough to be colonel of the Royal Gurkha Rifles, which is like the tribal chief, if you will, of the Royal Gurkha Rifles.
And you've served them in tough theatres of war. We described that a little bit in the introduction, you know, that they do have a reputation for being fearless and fearsome. But when you see those men in action, what is it about their fighting character? And it's interesting because you know, anecdotally, we whenever you see a member of the royal family who's served in the services, that they're kind of their reflection of how much they admire these people. Anybody who seems to come across them seems to end up being really kind of slightly awestruck by them.
They come from, Nepal still has a very extended family system, so they're very accustomed to looking after each other, and you get the sense of tremendous teamwork. And there's a tremendous drive to support each other. So where you see them in Afghanistan, for example, and they've been deployed since 2001, almost constantly in various rotations to go through, they get on with the people as well. They have an empathy with Afghan people. They are less dissimilar than you and I to Afghans. They speak the language. They have an ability to empathise with people who are living in abject poverty, because much of Nepal is like that. So they are good at empathising with the people they're operating amongst. But there is just this tremendous sense of loyalty, this tremendous sense of commitment. And many of them are sons and grandsons of soldiers themselves. And if you look at the number of awards that have been won in Afghanistan, and Sergeant Diprasad Pun, who won a Conspicuous Gallantry Cross at just below a Victoria Cross in September 2010, for an act of remarkable bravery, defending his fort against, single-handedly, against an onslaught of Taliban who were determined to get in and try and kill all those people who were there. And he ended up having to draw his kukri to defend himself. And there is still that sense of commitment. There's that sense of not wanting to let people down, that sense of not letting your teammate down. The British Army generally has this. British soldiers have this. But with Gurkhas, there just seems to be something special there.
And I wondered, we're talking about 200 years, we're celebrating 200 years of the British relationship with the Gurkhas. How do they celebrate their own history? Because I guess that's a different, I'd imagine they have a fairly similar streamlined idea of the relationship with the British. But do you get a sense of how they tell their history and whether their pride is placed in a slightly different place to the British view of it?
I think it's very similar. I think that there's been, in April, there were a series of celebrations held in Nepal, which were predominantly Nepalese Gurkhas who were taking part in those. And some British officers who'd served with them went over to take part as well. But there is a sense of pride. There is a tremendous sense of pride. It is something in Nepalese culture to have joined the British Army is a big thing. To have served with the British Army and served on operations is a big thing. And it brings a tremendous sense of pride. There is also, it is financially lucrative for them to do this as well. I mean, the terms and conditions are absolutely on a parallel with British soldiers now. And when you think that maybe 50, 60 pounds is what the average Nepalese earns in a month, the Gurkha soldier gets very much more than that. So it is financially lucrative. It is an honourable thing to do. It is something that is worthwhile. It is something that will set the family up. Because of this extended family, a Gurkha soldier working in the British Army will send money back to educate his siblings, will send money back to educate his more extended family, who are less fortunate than he is.
Now, Craig, in recent years, there's been a little bit of adjustment of the relationship. There was some feeling that we were not doing good by people who had served for us in the way that we then treated them with nationality. And there was a great campaign around that. And there have often been questions in the past, you know, will this continue? What's your feeling about both our relationship, you know, what our commitment should be and what the commitment will be going forwards?
I think where we are now is where we should be. The terms and conditions of service are absolutely on a parity with British soldiers, which is where it should be. There was a period of transition when that wasn't the case, and that was largely a legacy of a thing called the Tripartite Agreement, which was a contract effectively signed between Britain, India and Nepal after partition in 1947, when it was agreed that Britain could continue to recruit Gurkhas, but they must be... their conditions must be similar to those of Gurkhas serving in the Nepalese army and the Indian army. But things have moved on, and the West has developed faster, possibly, than India, certainly than Nepal. And so the terms and conditions needed to be adjusted to reflect that. And of course, Gurkhas were originally recruited to police the empire. Well, the empire is no longer there, so it is right that these conditions have changed. As we go forward, the key to the Gurkhas' continued longevity is the ability to demonstrate value for money and operational effectiveness. You know, provided we continue to do that, provided we continue to offer value for money and provide a capability, really, that I would say exceeds the capability provided by British regiments in many areas, particularly jungle operations, particularly operating in areas where the ethnicity is not white Anglo-Saxon, it is different, then they are force multipliers. For as long as that continues, then I believe the future is very rosy. Were we not to be like that, were we not to be proven to be operationally capable, then clearly people would have to review whether it were worth keeping them going.
And the operational capability thing is an interesting thing because I guess 200 years in the last 30 years, the jobs that the Gurkhas are doing, and any soldier in the British Army or any army pretty much has been doing, changes quite a lot. Is the adaptability, should we add loyalty, should we add adaptability to loyalty and sort of fearsome fighting power?
I think that's a really good point. I mean, if you think back to the Brunei Revolt or Borneo, you know, April 63 to August 66, it was predominantly a Gurkha campaign. The director of operations was a chap called Walter Walker, who was a Gurkha. And they started conducting these cloud operations across the border into Indonesia. And because it was jungle and because it was physically demanding, they served alongside the Royal Marines, they served alongside the SAS. It was at the cutting edge of light infanteering. And they lend themselves to that extremely well. Of course, they grow up in a climate which is different to what the average British soldier grows up in. So that gives them an edge in terms of certain environments. If we are going to continue to want to play in those sort of theatres, to want to deploy in those sort of theatres, then you're absolutely right. It makes sense. And Malaya, again, you know, 1948, 1960, it's absolutely an environment that lends itself to the physical robustness of the Gurkha soldier.
And the question that everybody will now want to know after your first answer is, when are you going to release the Get Fit Like a Gurkha DVD?
there's clearly a book.
It's a good
there,
idea, isn't it?
There is. Because I've seen them for Get Fit Like a Marine or Get okay. Fit for the SAS. Or
we
whatever.
Want to see those 12 push-ups or pull-ups.
I think it probably won't be me that's writing it, given I've never got to that level. But you're right. There's clearly a... and it is interesting. I mean, on the 1st of June of this year, the Gurkha Battalion in UK returned to the Airborne Brigade, to 16 Air Assault Brigade, which marks a return to airborne operations, which is just tremendous news for us. And it's partly because we just maintain this phenomenal level of fitness. It's always slightly daunting going back to a battalion at my age now and seeing whether I'm invited to go on a run with the battalion. Clearly, I'd rather do a curry lunch.
Nice. Well, the book is The Gurkhas, 200 Years of Service to the Crown. You heard from the author, Major General J.C. Lawrence Craig, to his pals. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed for having me.
Time for some brand new music now from New Zealand via the USA, Weird Poppers Unknown Mortal Orchestra. This is Necessary Evil from the new album Multi Love. That was New Zealand's Unknown Mortal Orchestra with Necessary Evil. And for more from them, tune in to the Midori House Sessions show on Monocle 24, where we have a nice session from the Unknown Mortal Orchestra. You're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly, though, and we'll be hearing more about London's Open City Documentary Festival up next.
Each spring, the Hamburg Messe provides a stage for everyone from seatmakers to dessert chefs, all porting airlines on a mission to be the safest and the most appealing carriers at 30,000 feet.
While past expos have focused on in-flight entertainment as ways to enhance a passenger's experience, this year the idea of augmented reality was front and center. Throughout the halls, makers displayed concepts on what it might mean to leave your seat, all while staying seated.
Flights of Fancy, a filmic look at innovation in the air, premiering now on Monocle.com.
The Open City Documentary Festival is taking place across London from the 16th of June to the 21st and aims to provide a nurturing environment for filmmakers depicting some of the most diverse scenes in non-fiction cinema with a creative approach to capturing real life.
One of those filmmakers is Catherine Round, whose film The Divide aims to show the inequality found within cities, focusing on individuals ranging from a fast food restaurant employee to a psychologist with a wandering eye on the heady heights of Wall Street. She joins us now along with the festival's producer, Chloe Trainer, to tell us more about it. Welcome both to the Monocle Weekly.
Chloe, we'll start with you. Let's talk about the festival and its origins and its ambitions. Tell us about it.
So Open City Documentary Festival started 5 years ago. It was actually born at UCL and it's now kind of developed into...
That's University College London for people listening around the world who don't know all our abbreviations.
Sorry about that. So we're now spread across London in 13 venues across the city and we take place over 6 days. Our kind of mission as a festival is to champion and nurture the art of creative documentary and non-fiction filmmakers. So that's kind of reflected in our film programme, and we also have a industry programme that runs alongside that as well, which is specifically aimed for filmmakers themselves.
And so tell us, when you say it's, you know, the creative side of it, now looking through some, there's quite a range of films that you have lined up this weekend. It doesn't seem to be too kind of pigeonholed, but is there a category of film you tend to be looking for when the documentary makers come knocking at your door?
Yeah, so the kind of...
I think that rhymed, actually. That was quite good. Come here.
The one thing that we kind of agreed at the beginning of this year we were going to look for in every film was that the audience would leave the cinema feeling like they'd experienced something. And beyond that, we're open to anything, which you can kind of see in how varied our programme is. So we're showing kind of more conventional, traditional kind of narrative documentary, but we're also showing things that are a bit more experimental, things that are purely observational versus things that are a bit more playing with documentary form as a whole. We show a lot of kind of hybrid work, which blurs that line between fact and fiction. But yeah, we kind of show a wide variety from all over the world, from lots of different filmmakers.
Now, Catherine, we should bring you in here. You're one of the filmmakers who is starring in this event. Yeah. Now, we watched a short part of your film before we came on air. It's about class, it's about money, it's about the wealth distribution. But I think what's kind of most interesting about the divide is that it's not just the people at the bottom end of it. You raise quite a kind of a philosophical question. It's that this kind of notion of the unequal society is kind of nagging at everybody's shoulder, even the people who sit in the middle class. They're unsure about where they sit in this vast spectrum where you have the super wealthy and the really impoverished.
Absolutely. I'm very pleased to hear your very excellent summary of the film. I mean, when I tell people I'm making a film about economics or inequality, normally everybody falls asleep at the very thought of it. And I suppose I really wanted to make a film that humanised something which can sort of seem like it should be in the Financial Times or that doesn't actually impact on everybody's lives. And, you know, this idea that we're all kind of part of this world where you stand is very, very important. And that isn't just, you know, obviously it's terrible, you know, it's much worse for you if you're at the very bottom. But even if you're in the middle or relatively rich, you know, your where you stand becomes much, much more important when you have a society which is hugely stratified by wealth.
Catherine, maybe you can talk us about casting your film and putting it together, because watching that excerpt, you know, you've got some people that people would tend to think are on the more conservative side of the spectrum, actually, and that might not, whose voices are not normally heard in this context of talking about money, but the other side of it. Mm-hmm. How did you whittle down your long list of contributors, and were they sort of pleased to be given the opportunity to talk about something which affects everybody, but which they're perhaps not known for talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it was really important for me when I started making this film not to make a film that, you know, basically was full of people where you could go, well, they would say that, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
So I really wanted to kind of reach, I wanted to primarily tell it through the voices of lived experience and people across the income spectrum. And I really wanted it to breathe as a documentary. I didn't want it to be just totally full of people's opinions and talking heads. I mean, obviously we do have opinions and people in the film and talking about different perspectives on it, but the sort of bulk of the film is experiencing characters. But when it came to some of the other voices in the film, which I think mainly what you're talking about, people like
Max Hastings.
Max Hastings.
A former editor of the Telegraph newspaper here in the UK, a well-known military critic. Yeah, anyway,
exactly.
So, yeah, so really interesting to hear him talking about wealth.
Exactly. And he was actually one of the first people that I interviewed for the film. And I was very keen from the very beginning that this wasn't going to be just the sort of usual suspects coming out saying the things that we all know that they say. And Max Hastings, to me, sort of encapsulates this what I think the film is about, which is that it isn't actually about a left-right division. It's about the very human impact of inequality. And that is something which can actually transcend politics in many, many ways. And Max's, you know, very pro-capitalist view is still that huge inequality is absolutely detrimental to the proper functioning of capitalism. So, you know, we can see that regardless of whether you are on his is his side of the fence or not, there's very interesting argument to be put out there about inequality, which isn't necessarily one that you would associate with those people.
Now, I want to bring both of you back in on a quick topic. Now, Catherine, we'll start with you on this. We'll stay with you for a second because you crowdfunded or you asked for money to help support your film. We've just heard from Chloe that there's a huge number of people, you know, fighting to get on the schedule at the documentary festival. Is it really competitive out there for documentaries? But yet there's so many being made. What's the environment like at this time?
It's tough. I mean, you know, let's be honest, it's tough. I mean, you know, these kinds of films are often made with very little financial backing. Crowdfunding is a new model. It's very exciting for filmmakers like me because it does mean that you can make these films that often, you know, what I call creative documentaries, which don't necessarily follow either the sort of usual television model of making films. They allow you to do things, they allow you to sort of slightly push the boundaries both in form and content and do something which actually is a bit more kind of out there, which I think is very, very good for the industry as a whole. But, you know, it is tough. You know, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to probably be crying about the lives of us poor, impoverished documentary makers.
That's a documentary to end all documentaries.
Yeah, but, you know, these are often projects that are made out of absolute passion and love. And, you know, I think that does come through in a lot of the work. I mean, I'm constantly inspired by the programme at Open City. I think, you know, the absolute range of work that's being produced at the moment is phenomenal. So I think it's a very exciting time to be a documentary filmmaker, if a little bit tough.
Chloe, you're not at Sundance, but are people using this festival to sell their films, to find new markets for them? Or are many of these films actually being made for this festival circuit?
A lot of the films that we show are kind of festival films that wouldn't normally have much traction in terms of theatrical distribution. And that's kind of one of the purposes of what Open City does, we think, of giving those filmmakers a platform to get them out to audiences. We try and bring as many of the filmmakers to the festival so that they can meet their audience and talk to them, have Q&As. Because, yeah, it's tough. There's a lot of competition for cinema space from all films at the moment, because so many are being produced. So yeah, that's what we see the role of the festival as.
And we're talking about, I sometimes wonder if there's a bit of a golden age for documentaries, so many fantastic ones, and the ones that are, you know, front and centre in people's minds maybe are the ones that have the fantastic distribution, naturally enough. But is this a fallout from the way that TV is commissioned, do you think? Not just in the UK, but across the world, the fact that things like Big Brother, it counts as a factual programme. Does that annoy you, or does that make your job easier perhaps to put together a documentary festival because the kind of TV model is slightly broken?
And it does feel that when you turn the TV on, there's so little to really engage you and watch. So, you know, because everything has to be a series, and the question that you're dealing with is reduced to something like Big Brother to Benefit Street rather than being a question that can be looked at in a more nuanced way.
Yeah, one of the reasons the festival was started was because films that would normally have been commissioned through places like the BBC that are a bit more kind of cinematic and they're not, like you say, factual content, weren't being commissioned anymore and things were changing and budgets were tightening. So, yeah, Open City was really born out of that, where there wasn't a place for these filmmakers to go anymore. So, yeah, and we really enjoy being able to meet those filmmakers and screen their work and... Yeah, and it's a great experience.
Is there, I mean, and it's one of those things, I mean, people might also be familiar with the Sheffield Documentary Festival and with CPH Docs in Copenhagen. Andrew mentioned Sundance, and there's obviously documentary festivals all over the world of great quality, like the ones we've just name-checked. Do you have to set out your stall as being something else? Do they have to set out their stall so people might know the sort of films that will get included in a certain festival's package?
Yeah, I think we have conversations a lot about this at work, about what kind of sets us apart from other festivals. And I think it's really key, just like for filmmakers to set out what they do and what their objectives are, for festivals to do that as well, because each festival has its own kind of merits and what it can give to the filmmakers. And yeah, our kind of remit, like I said, is giving filmmakers who might not normally get their work screened out there to audiences and kind of bringing those people together. We're kind of trying to create a community here in London for people to come together every June and meet each other and just kind of talk about how much they love documentary.
So. Now, Catherine, you need to make some money to keep going. But so tell me, what we're saying about the broken TV model, but for you, what's the balancing act? Is it doing things like this matched with commercial work? Can you make some money from the festival circuit? And what next for you?
Good question. A question I ask myself every day, how to make money. I mean, I think the sort of tough reality is when you're engaged on a project like this, which has been several years for me in the making, you know, you're not going to get paid for it. You're going to be, you know, working all the hours to kind of get the project off the ground. But, you know, I think that the model for filmmakers these days is to obviously mix and match the projects that they do. I mean, I do come from a television background originally, and I do still sometimes make films for television in between doing some of my more ambitious feature projects like this one. And what was the other bit of your question?
What next for you?
Will there be
another independent documentary that you'd like to do?
Yeah, I mean, I'm up at Sheffield. Shouldn't talk about my fashion. I'm up at Sheffield this weekend.
Chloe's hissing at it.
I know, it's terrible. And we're pitching another big idea, actually, which is I've started moving into interactive filmmaking as well. So this idea of how you can sort of change the method of storytelling to make it very active and inclusive and immersive for the audience, rather than just a sort of sit in a cinema experience, although that is also very immersive, but in a different way. So we're up there pitching a big project on climate change this week. So that could be the next thing.
Well, Catherine and Chloe, thank you very much for coming to this, and good luck with the festival.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And those listeners in London can enjoy the films of Open City from the 16th to the 21st of June. Up next, we'll hear from the war reporter, Charles Glass.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
The Syrian civil war, now in its fourth year, has claimed over 200,000 lives and displaced an estimated 8 million people from their homes. Today, the country finds itself caught between the control of totalitarian leader Bashar al-Assad and radical Islamic State forces. It's a world away from the once richly varied and subtly hued makeup of a country with thousands of years of history that, although living under the Assad regime, was until recently at peace.
Charles Glass has reported from the Middle East and travelled throughout Syria over the space of several decades. And his new book, Syria Burning, ISIS and the Death of the Arab Spring, looks at the country that once was, while pursuing the role and responsibility of Western governments in the demise of a nation. Have they done enough? And Charles joins us now from Provence in France. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Charles. And we should say that you is a region you know incredibly well. You were there with ABC. You've connections to Lebanon, personal family connections. When you look at that part of the world and the Levant, and especially Syria, what do you feel that we have particularly lost?
Something began in the late 19th century, which is continuing today, which is displacement of minorities, people being driven into ghettos or being driven out of the region entirely, from the Greeks of Anatolia, the Armenians in the First World War who were victims of genocide, the displacement of the Palestinians by the Israelis in 1948, the displacement of Christians and Muslims in Lebanon to different parts of the country during the Civil War from 1975 to 1990, the displacement of the Zoroastrians and others in Iran after the Islamic Revolution of 1979, the terrible displacement of people, especially the Christians, but also Shiites, Muslims, and Kurds after the American invasion of Iraq in 2003, and now the very bloody ethnic and sectarian cleansing of Syria by the Islamist movements there, who ideologically do not want Christians to remain either in Syria or Iraq, and they do not want the Yazidis or the Armenians or any other minority to remain. It's a tragic denouement to a process that began a long time ago and which need not have happened.
It's one of the tragedies also, Charles, the fact that it is it is so complicated, this moving around of peoples, this ethnic cleansing, as you put it as well. There is no very clear narrative, perhaps, for so much of the news media to pick up on other than bombardment and bombing and war. Do you think that is perhaps part of the problem, that why we misunderstand what is going on in Syria? And perhaps, and you've written about this very much recently as well, why the United States administration misunderstands Syria?
Well, one of the problems, of course, is that in the area itself, in Syria and in Iraq, there are problems, there are sectarian differences which have been brought out by the conflict and been made much worse by the conflict. The Syrian regime, for all of its flaws, was able to manage the minorities because it was itself a minority regime. And Christians, Armenians, Druze, and others prospered under the Assad regime. The arming of the opposition to Assad, largely encouraged by the United States, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, was a turning point which led to this escalation of violence, the growth of Islamism, which the Defense Intelligence Agency report, which was leaked recently, showed that the U.S. was very well aware of from 2012, shows that they had an understanding of what was going on, but they didn't really care what was going on. They were willing to allow a caliphate, a pseudo-caliphate, to be established in the desert between Syria and Iraq if it had a chance of bringing down the Assad regime, which was the prime motive for American support for the opposition in the first place.
Charles, I wanted to ask you, when we look at the Arab Springs and we look at the narratives that have come out of those countries, there's two things that the West is criticized for. In nations where they intervened, in the likes of Libya, the narrative is, you know, that we shouldn't have intervened. If we had left it alone, it would have been a local issue. Or if we did intervene, we needed to have a longer term policy. In Syria, actually, it went to a vote at the UN. It, you know, that here in the UK, it had to go to the parliament. People decided that they didn't want to get involved in going to full-scale war. And in a way, now people are being criticised here for not getting involved, for not doing more on the ground, for not sending troops. When you look back at those early months of the Arab Spring hitting in Damascus, hitting in Syria, what do you think the West should have done at that time?
I think the West should have stayed out of it at that time and should have stayed out of the Middle East at all times. Most of the problems of the Middle East go back to the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire by the British and the French in 1920 and the arrangement that came out of that. The United States has repeatedly intervened in Syria. The United States staged the very first military coup in Syria in 1949 over the oil pipeline from Saudi Arabia to Lebanon. In order to have the Syrians approve it quickly, they put in the chief of staff of the army, Colonel Hosni Zaim, and that led to a series of military coups and the overthrow of a civilian democracy, a parliamentary democracy that Syria had from 1946 to 1949, from which the country has never recovered. Now, when you say that the U.S. or the U.S. and its client states should have intervened, they were intervening in Syria all along. They were arming the opposition, they were encouraging the opposition, they were ignoring those in the opposition who wanted to keep a non-violent civil disobedience campaign going to force the regime to reform itself or to allow a transition to genuine elections. And they, by arming and financing the armed elements of the opposition, they helped to turn it into a war. Now, if you were proposing that American, British, French forces should have invaded Syria the way they invaded Iraq in 2003, well, we saw the outcome of Iraq, of the American occupation. I think it would have been very similar in Syria. There was never a constituency in Syria for an American occupation.
It might be a bit of a cheap truism, Charles, but the idea that we think that sometimes in these conflicts, our enemies' enemies can be our friends, that's not the case in Syria, is it at all? I mean, I wonder whether you think that there is a problem that we don't know who we should be fighting.
Well, the United States all along has been fighting the Syrian regime, helping so-called moderates, but the moderates end up to be mainly from the Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Islamist Front, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. The United States, because of its wanting to dispose of Bashar al-Assad, making that its first priority, because of his relationship with Iran, his dependence on Iran, because of his relationship with Russia, and because of his support for Hezbollah, which annoyed Israel, it put that as a priority. But now you have the problem that the United States is suffering in Iraq because of something that came out of Syria, the Islamic State, and on the one hand, it is bombing the Islamic State and wanting to destroy the Islamic State to preserve a pro-American regime in Baghdad. At the same time, ignore the fact that the Islamic State is also fighting in Syria, and as long as it has Syria as a base of operations, it can go in and out of Iraq as it likes and go on fighting. If you think back to the Second World War, 1939, Germany invaded Poland, and then Britain and France declared war on Germany. But at the same time, Stalin invaded Poland, and the Soviet Union occupied half of Poland, but they didn't declare war on the Soviet Union. It wasn't because the Soviet Union was a decent place or Stalin was a humane figure. The fact was that they couldn't afford to fight both countries at once. And in the event when Hitler attacked the Soviet Union, the British and the French welcomed Stalin for all of his crimes as an ally. Now, they're not making a similar calculation now with the Islamic State in that they might consider dealing with Bashar al-Assad, let him use his army against the Islamic State in the West while they use the Iraqi army and the Kurds in the East to have a hammer and anvil policy to squeeze the Islamic State and drive it out of existence. But they're not doing that policy. So as a result, they are effectively, through the Saudis, the Qataris and the Turks, helping the Islamic State in Syria while opposing it in Iraq.
And it's interesting bringing up those historical parallels, Charles. Have you found that it's easier to explain the problems in Syria and the region through a historical lens? Is that what you'd encourage people to do?
You can't understand what's happening today unless you understand what happened yesterday. And that's true in any part of the world, particularly in the Middle East with this bloody history of the 20th century. It plays an important role in what's happening in the 21st century. I think many people in Washington have read the history and do know the history, but they think somehow they can ignore it.
And can I ask you, Charles, when you look across the border these days at Lebanon, oddly, it seems to hold out quite a nice image of what can happen after a terrible civil war. You know, although there's many fractions and it's always precarious and it's always on the edge of falling apart, there, you know, you do see people who are Christians and Druze and Maronites and Catholics and all sorts of different faiths kind of still holding it just about together. But when you look at what's happening in Syria, do you think there's any hope that we could even get to that kind of position in 10 years' time? Or do you think the narrative now is just so awful that there is no clear way ahead?
I think there was a hope almost 2 years ago when the Syrian opposition and the Syrian regime went to Geneva to meet with the Americans and the Russians and the Saudis and the Turks and others who were involved. But the outside powers who are backing the various factions, so remember that Russia and Iran are backing the regime, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, the United States, Britain and France are backing the opposition. These people did not use their leverage with the regime and the opposition to force a settlement. In 1989, this is what happened in Lebanon. After 15 years of civil war, the outside benefactors of all the Lebanese militias, and remember, Lebanon doesn't manufacture arms, Lebanon doesn't have much money, it needed outside support to keep that war going. Well, all of those outside powers had had enough. And so they brought the Lebanese leaders to Taif in Saudi Arabia. They forced a new constitution down their throats, which most of them didn't like. However, it did end the war, and the Lebanese population can tell you it's a lot better living now without worrying about being kidnapped or shot or shelled as you go to work. And something similar could have happened in Syria a couple of years ago if the United States and the Soviet Union had agreed a plan to impose on the various Syrian factions under threat of denying them the weapons and the weapons, arms and money that they needed to carry on the war. It may still be possible, but given the state of relations between the US and Russia at this time, it doesn't look very hopeful.
Well, much further reading is required on this subject. Best place to start is Syria Burning, ISIS and the Death of the Arab Spring by Charles Glass. Charles, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And you can order Charles's book via the OR Books website. And that's all we have for edition 309 of the Monocle Weekly, Andrew. We thought at the beginning of that programme it was going to be a very serious programme. It was going to be more shade than light and shade, but what an enlightening few interviews we managed to pack into that Monocle Weekly. I enjoyed it.
Well, Charles Glass is probably properly a bit of a legend, but I think we're both a bit scared. We're looking a little bit kind of like ordinary for a military man to come in here. Came in his nice suit and tie. But what a great guy.
Yeah, he was cool, wasn't he?
And I think the fascinating thing is, you know, that he is obviously so passionate about those guys and that what they do and their history. And it's just really intriguing to see that, he explained to us, you have to learn Nepalese to be able to join the Gurkhas. And I think it immerses you in a different culture. It's just really a fascinating, fascinating world.
And it was a bit frustrating, actually, because that fact about, you have to speak Nepalese to be able to be a Gurkha or part of that regiment meant that we only asked him that question after we'd switched the microphones off and after we finished the interview. Otherwise, obviously, we'd have done the whole thing in Nepalese.
Well, we do actually have three Gurkhas who work for us here. We could have brought them in.
That would have been good. We should have tested them out.
Yeah.
Isn't that what Sabine does in interviews when people say they speak sort of fluent?
Yeah, she just moves into the language.
Fluent German or fluent French or fluent Dutch.
Fluent anything. She's got all those languages.
That's how
down.
We catch people out.
Yeah, certainly is.
Glad I joined before that time.
Well, I don't have any claims to any educational ability on my CV, so it makes it much easier.
Conversational English.
Can string a sentence together, I think it says.
Let's thank our team. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant and Tom Hall and researched by Claire Urban, who is also on the desk as our studio manager. The Monocle Week will be back again, same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.